Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Is the woke agenda on the decline in America? Let's get to the bottom line. While the Democrats pat themselves on the back for doing better than they thought they would in the elections earlier this month, an interesting trend is emerging. Both conservative and liberal Americans moved to the center, and they rejected hardliners. Of course, there's some exceptions here and there. But political demands like defund the police that were once popular after the murder of George Floyd by a white policeman in Minnesota 2 years ago, well, they really weren't on the agenda at all this cycle. So what's the future of identity politics, of social justice, critical race theory, things like climate absolutism, language policing, and canceling people? Will wokeism take a back seat in the Democratic Party from now on as it tries to reach for normies in the middle? Has the pendulum swung the other way, especially now that the big 2024 election is fast approaching? Today, we're talking with Rui Teixeira, a political scientist who predicted in his book written 20 years ago, The Emerging Democratic Majority, that America's demographics were shifting toward a new progressive era. Rui, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Look, I remember doing one of the launch events for your and John Judas's book about the coming progressive era, the shift in demographics in the United States and how this was, what came undone? And I'd love that you've written a very provocative article called The Peak of Wokeism. And I'm interested in what you see as the fundamental dynamics, not only for the Democratic Party, but also for the Republican right now.
Yeah, well, going back to, our book, which came out 20 years ago, I mean, one thing we did talk about in the book was, yes, these things were changing in America. You mentioned the, demographics. There were other things as well, but it did seem like Democrats were well-positioned to practice a sort of progressive centrism that could knit these emerging constituencies together into a fairly strong majority coalition that might have some durability, and that seemed to happen in 2008. Obama election seemed to bring a lot of these constituencies together, as well as, very importantly, doing fairly strongly for a contemporary Democrat among white working class voters, which we talked about in the book, which was widely ignored. But we thought that if they stayed on that course, they might, in fact, be able to realize this emerging majority. I mean, I think in a very broad brush terms, what's happened since then has taken the Democrats away from what we might call this progressive centrism, this emerging sort of common sense of America, and taking it in pretty different directions. And it's a longer story that John Judas and I are going to detail in our new book, Where Have All the Democrats Gone?, about the evolution of the Democratic Party in the last 20 years, that will come out next year. But certainly one thing that happened, and you mentioned, the rise of the question of woke and peak wokeism and what have you, is that the Democrats really did move pretty solidly to the left on cultural issues in a way that does put them at variance with, I think, the median voter and the common sense of America. And this really took force, I think, after Hillary Clinton lost to Trump in 2016, and Democrats cast about for some explanation, any explanation, for how they managed to lose to this buffoon. And I think what they basically settled on is that the people who voted for him and moved against him in the Midwest states and moved toward him in the Midwest states were a bunch of, racist, xenophobic troglodytes who represented the declining America. And we shouldn't worry about them anyway, and they're hopeless, et cetera. And I think that set the Democrats on a bit of a course toward endorsing a lot of these more outre and hardline tenets of identity politics. And I think that obviously becomes turbocharged in the George Floyd summer, where it sort of seemed to take over all the institutions in America and with which the Democratic Party is pretty identified. So you put all that together with, I think, the aftermath of the Great Recession, where a lot of areas of the country never really recovered from that, and in fact had been going through an economic transition for decades that made them think their communities were being left behind and were looked down upon by the elites on the coast. I mean, you put all that together, those economic changes taking place in the country to which people didn't feel Democrats were responsive, and this sort of increasing cultural alienation, almost a chasm between what dominates the Democratic Party and the discourse and sort of the media, academia, nonprofits, right, advocacy groups, and the sort of the average voter. Well, so that's where we got, sort of the the situation we found ourselves in the summer of 2020, and we still find ourselves in today. And then the question I was addressing, you alluded to, has that cultural leftism or radicalism, that wokeism, has it peaked? And I think there are some signs in this recent election and then some of the things that have happened since 2020 that at least in the broad society it's peaked. What I'm less sure of, Steve, is whether it's peaked in the institutions where a lot of these people are entrenched. They have significant power and resources, and they ain't backing down.
Do you think it's the tactics? I think one of the struggles that I have with this is I think America has been a racist society. I think that you did see redlining that kept black communities stuck without assets and without financing. You saw differences in institutions, et cetera. But part of it is the crusades and the kind of we call it canceling people. Anything you may have done in the past that might have been on the wrong side of a line is ending up disrupting, so that in an effort to try to evolve norms and civil justice, social justice, there's also harm created. And I'm just interested in whether that is part of the woke culture that voters and citizens are saying, we didn't sign up for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's clearly happening. I mean, I think in the the George Floyd summer, so to speak, and its immediate aftermath, no one could really say a discouraging word about Black Lives Matter, about the concept that all white people are privileged, that America is a white supremacist society, that, you know, all white people are complicit in maintaining structural racism, et cetera, and all of which is far different than sort of acknowledging America's racist past, the way it may have some echoes in today's society. Some of the things that were done in the past were very bad, but you know, this basically a loser politically and departs from the common sense of Americans to say, well, every one of you folks is guilty, and the only real problem in this country is structural racism, which must be eradicated, and that explains all differences in society, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that kind of approach, that kind of analysis, and sort of the cancellation sort of culture that grew up around it, where unless you acquiesced or endorsed these kinds of points of views, you were subject to being mobbed on social media and otherwise, you know, sort of put at a disadvantage, maybe lose your job. It's a really unpleasant culture. It wasn't a discourse trying to understand the good and bad of American history or the good and bad of American society today. It was, in a sense, enforcing an almost ideological conformity in a lot, you know, wide sectors of the country and wide sectors of institutions. And I think there is a reaction against it. I think people are sick of it. I think they don't believe this is, you know, America's intrinsically a, you know, racist dystopian place that, you know, people of color can barely subsist in. I don't think people of color believe that. So I think there's really a move away from that, again, in the common discourse. But I think what's interesting is that it's still well entrenched in the institutions, And in certain sectors of the Democratic Party as well. And I think that going back to the 2022 election, I think that I'm not sure the signals that the Democratic Party is receiving from this election are going to put them on a course toward moving to the cultural center. Because I think a lot of elements of the party basically summarize the election as saying, well, you know, we proved that if we just talk about cultural issues, in this case, abortion and, you know, January 6th and what have you, that's really going to be adequate to insulate us from all these criticisms about crime, immigration, gender ideology, race essentialism, and general woke culture. I mean, woke culture basically is not a problem. We need to change nothing, as Biden famously put it after the election. Mm. So I think that the extent Democrats need, and I do believe it's true, to move to the cultural center and sort of re-embrace the common sense of America, I think this election, oddly enough, may not put them on the right course, even though I think you're right, Steve, that voters in general were rejecting extremes on both sides and showed that they wanted to, you know, have some semblance of political normality in our country.
Right. Well, one of the questions I have, and you wrote this very interesting piece in The Atlantic recently, you know, looking at how the Democrats lost the white working class. And I'm interested in, you know, the antenna of those white working class, many of whom have gone to vote for Donald Trump or moved into the Republican Party, but they're finding a party that has very big currents of evangelical Christianity, a very big currents of QAnon conspiracies, very big elements of, you know, some elements of, you know, corporate supremacy in some part of this. And I'm just interested in whether that's a comfortable alignment on the Republican side of the equation now that they have moved away from the Democrats.
Yeah, I don't think it's a completely stable alignment. I think that there are many aspects of today's Republican Party that a lot of these voters would be uncomfortable with. I mean, even on something like abortion, most white working class voters, including most of them who would consider voting for Republicans, are, you know, probably moderately pro-choice, so certainly not for banning abortion in all circumstances. And critically, you mentioned the issue of corporate influence and power and what have you. These voters are actually quite populist in an economic sense. They don't really trust the capitalists to take care of them, so to speak. And they're not averse to the government playing a role in making their lives better. They just don't trust the government to do it. But they're not at all sort of your classic quasi-libertarian, get the government off our backs, just cut taxes and that's all we need to do kind of Republicans. They're coming out of a different bag. And it is a bit, it's a challenge for Republicans now that they have become such a working class party to figure out how to take care of these voters and actually improve their lives instead of just taking advantage of the fact these voters feel culturally alienated and somewhat betrayed by the Democratic Party. So I do think that's a big problem for them. And I actually would add to this, Steve, that if you look at other gains the Republicans have been making, they've increasingly becoming a multiracial working class party. They're doing a lot better among Hispanic working class voters, especially, and even to some extent, much less among Black working class voters. So how do you keep those voters in your coalition? There's evidence from this election that, again, Hispanics move fairly strongly toward the Republicans in 2022. So, and these are overwhelmingly working class voters. So how do you keep those voters in the fold in a Republican Party that has all these moving parts? And these are not Hispanic voters who are necessarily, certainly not enamored of the traditional economic agenda of the Republican Party. They're not even that enamored of sort of some of the Trump crazy. They just really don't like the Democratic Party, and they like some of what Republicans are saying and doing, but not all of it by any stretch of the imagination. What they're looking for, and this is a mistake the Democrats have made, Hispanic voters are not sort of primarily immigration voters or primarily usefully thought of as people of color. They're patriotic, hardworking, socially moderate to conservative people, primarily concerned about upward mobility and finding their place in America, which I actually think is a pretty good country, and, you know, sort of making sure their children have a better life. So Democrats, they used to trust them much more in this, I think, than they do today. But Republicans, even though they're giving them a try, I guess one way I think about this, Steve, is they're renting these Hispanic working class voters. They haven't really succeeded in purchasing them completely.
And owning them. You know, one of the things I've been writing about and talking about over the last, you know, couple of years is that, you know, particularly I, you know, organize a lot of events in Washington, and we somehow, you know, sometimes we sort of fake the issue that we're creating a bipartisan event by having a Republican and a Democrat in an event. But oftentimes the divides within the parties are much more serious than between the parties. We've been watching the battle over Build Back Better, the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, the Joe Manchin wing of the party, you know, versus the AOC wing, you know, and this has been going on a long time. But it does really raise the question, and I know you watch this. I'm just interested in how these schisms internally, traditionally get processed so that you see some, not unity, but sort of a consensus as to what the fundamental principles of that party are. And I don't think the Democrats have done that yet. I'm interested in what you think.
Yeah, I think neither party, I mean, I think broadly speaking, you know, I talked about the need for the Democrats to move to the center, particularly in cultural issues. And there's other things that could be said. I mean, you mentioned climate absolutism a while ago on your introduction, I think. And I think that's a division between the left and the center of the party, just how many chips you're going to put on that particular issue and how much of a price you're willing to pay for a clean energy transition. And what about, you know, sort of the needs and concerns of the working class? But that's sort of, in a broad sense, there's a left of the party which wants to press the accelerator on a lot of this stuff. in their economic program. We saw the debate around Build Back Better. You talked about where they wanted to spend a gazillion dollars on everything, which wasn't particularly popular. And of course, on cultural issues, the left of the party is adamant that it wants to change nothing at all. Nothing at all. They don't want to back down on crime. They don't want to back down on immigration. They don't want to back down on, you know, so the way they talk about race and the sort of general rhetoric they use, they don't want to back down at all. And yet there's a reasonable case to be made that what Democrats really need to change their image, which is still pretty terrible in wide swaths of America, is a sort of sister soldier moment where they sort of make it clear that Democrats do not stand for some of this sort of pretty radical stuff associated with the left of the party. I mean, my recommendation of this a while ago is they need a Chesa Boudin moment. Chesa Boudin famously got thrown out as DA of San Francisco by the liberal voters of San Francisco because they thought he was totally falling down on the job in terms of crime, homelessness, and public disorder. Why, you know, would have been a great time to say voters of San Francisco have spoken. We Democrats were tough on crime or tough on the causes of crime. And we don't hold with people, even in our own party, we don't put public safety first and foremost, which is a little bit what Josh Shapiro said in his run for governor of Pennsylvania, which I thought was very good. So you need those attention-grabbing, media-friendly, everyone will hear about it moments where you ostentatiously move the party to the center against the left. And I think on the part of the Republicans, the division's fairly clear. It's between the dead-end Trumpers and the emerging consensus in a lot of areas of the party that Trump is an electoral liability. We can't run in this way. We can't have those kind of politics. And we can't have that guy. I mean, if you look at the data from the 2022 election, it just couldn't be clearer that Republicans' bad night, relatively speaking, was primarily attributable to Trump-backed candidates and being associated with Trumpism in general. This was a secret sauce for the Democrats. It's been estimated that Republicans paid a 5 or 6 point penalty in competitive districts and in Senate races for having those kinds of candidates, having those kind of associations. So the debate in the party will come down to people who want to essentially move on from Trump and people who do not. And neither one of those things will be easy to resolve for either party. But I think those are the divisions that will be operative in the coming period.
I'm just interested as we watch an anti-woke guy, Elon Musk, come in and, you know, essentially, I think, dismantle Twitter. Do you think that some of these social media platforms are going to come undone as you see wokeism decline?
Well, I think it'll take some of the wind out of their sails. I mean, I don't think there's any question that some of the changes we've talked about, Steve, have been enabled by the rise of social media, particularly Twitter, and the kind of nature of the conversations and the sort of, quote, interactions, unquote, that it produces and the ability to gang up on people, essentially, and enforce norms. You know, I think the best thing Elon Musk could do for Twitter is just take those servers and fire them into outer space in one of his rockets. I mean, I think that would be quite productive for the social discourse. So, yeah, I think there's reasons to be mildly optimistic that if social media is dismantled or otherwise, the parts of it are dismantled or otherwise sort of takes less of a front seat in our political culture, things will get a little bit better. Personally, I stay off of Twitter entirely and I detest the medium. And I've seen my basic view is almost nothing good has come out of it. So Elon, fire those servers into outer space.
It's probably going to make it to Twitter in the last gasping moments of Twitter. but let me also talk to you about a new crowd coming in. Nancy Pelosi is, of course, stepping down as Speaker of the House. A new raft of leaders has nominated itself to come in. Hakeem Jeffries at the lead from Brooklyn, New York. And I'd just be interested in what kind of counsel you would give them about restoring what you consider to be health to democratic discourse. You know, this town, Washington, D.C., was never supposed to be a place for the kumbaya, you know, part of this is a place where ideas and issues struggle against each other. But it's become so toxic. And I'm interested in what you would advise them to do by way of undoing some of this toxicity and trying to set a tone that's healthier for their kind of leadership in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I like Hakeem Jeffries, and I do think it was time for someone else to step up. I mean, Pelosi's got a few years on her, and I think people are looking for new and younger leadership. That said, I mean, one thing I worry about with Jeffries is One of the hardest parts of the job will be, you know, how do you actually herd the cats that constitute the Democratic caucus, and which cats do you have to knock on the side of the head to get them to behave? I think the nature of the sort of ascending to the level he has is he's had to be friends with all sides of the Democratic caucus, progressive, moderate, and all the various flavors in between. And I think that may make him uninclined to do the kind of knocking of heads that might be necessary to have the most productive possible minority caucus in this coming Congress.
Let me ask you finally, Rui, about the health of Democratic discourse in Washington, the role of think tanks, the role of policy writers and journalists like myself and yourself. Are we doing a good job? And I'm just interested in whether the institutions that were supposed to be about objective distance and about, you know, trying to think about policy choices for the country, are they in a healthy spot?
No, it's not healthy at all, Steve. I mean, it's pretty corrupt, I guess you could say. I'm now at the American Enterprise Institute. I moved over from the Center for American Progress. And AEI, while it leans right, has serious scholars, and they do, you know, sort of believe in civil discourse, and they do try to do real analysis about real stuff, and they're not really necessarily towing any party line. But I think it's, you know, basically with some exceptions, I guess Brookings and exception, a few others, most of the so-called think tanks in Washington are basically pretty party line, pretty partisan, pretty causey, as it were. I mean, they've decided they're with one tribe or the other, and they basically tend to produce stuff that reflects the point of view of their side and sort of enlists in that army. And, you know, increasingly the internal cultures of these think tanks, and of course, especially advocacy groups, lean toward policing the views of people within the think tank and the sort of research they produce to make sure it supports and says the appropriate things. I mean, back to wokeism, I mean, big problem on the left, very difficult to produce research or even have discussions in a lot of these institutions that depart from the conventional woke wisdom about a variety of things. So, I think it's not in a good place, not in a good place right at all. And I think that the think tank world needs this sort of, movement toward reform and toward trying to be more credible and objective and even-handed in the analysis that these institutions do. That said, do I have any hope it's going to happen anytime soon? No.
Well, I hope you'll come back another time and kick around that topic with me, because that deserves a whole show. Political scientist Rui Teixeira, thanks so much for being with us today. This was terrific. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what's the bottom line? Radical progressives have brought real change to American society. Misogyny and sexual harassment, well, they used to be accepted, tacitly encouraged, and then just laughed off. Ha-ha, boys will be boys. Racism was, and it still is, baked into American education, into employment, voting participation, home buying, even marriage laws. Gays and lesbians were harassed, discriminated against, murdered. There are injustices and grievances throughout American society, just like any society. But there are always folks here willing to speak truth to power and fight for change, no matter how long, how complex, and how controversial the struggle is. The culture wars are like a pendulum. They swing left and right over time. My guest today might be right. The woke movement may have reached the point where it faces too much blowback for now. The trick for American society will be finding a way to undo historic harms in a way that ends up with a healthier society. And that's the bottom line.